I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Stepping back in time here with the conductor Craig Smith, most famous for his Bach cantatas every Sunday at the Emanuel Church in Boston, also for his PBS restagings of Mozart's Italian operas in modern Manhattan settings. For more than 30 years, Craig Smith was the sole standard bearer and secret hero in the zealous hive of Boston music. He conducted his last Bach cantata just 10 days before his death in mid-November 2007 from complications of diabetes. 15 years ago, he and I made this documentary for WGBH Television in Boston, and we called it A Way to Live, Craig Smith's Bach Project. It opened in the coffee shop near Porter Square, Cambridge, where Craig had his breakfast every morning.
Well, I got a job singing in this church choir downtown at Emanuel Church. The director of music left, resigned precipitously, and they really were desperate. I'll have coffee with cream.
Cream?
I didn't play organ. I had never done anything like this. And I had been listening to Bach cantatas and really had loved them, and had this nutty idea to try to do one every week. We had no money, and we had a few students that were willing to come in. And I was copying parts in the middle of the night, and it was wild. And so that's how it happened.
Craig, this has been going on for
ages.
20 years now.
Over 20 years, yes.
Were you doing it one Sunday at a time?
Well, we did it every Sunday. We just started a series and did, I think it was 16 in a row or something.
By now it's, what, 200 and some?
We've done them all, yes, and many of them many times.
Do you suppose Bach thought of these as sermons?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it that he considered his function very much like the preacher. And in fact, the service had these two elements. It had a sermon, and then it had the cantata, which was the musical sermon.
Do you think of them as sermons?
Yes, I do. Our performances are about the words.
Interesting, because of course they're in German. How many people in your congregation are following the words?
Oh, we pass them out in German and English, and I hope they all are.
Speak in Cantata number 8, for example. Talk about these words, the words of the chorale, words of the whole piece. The
Cantata 8 is in a way an extreme example, in that it is a theological idea that is very appealing now, but I don't know anyone that can really go with it, which is that death is wonderful and is a wonderful release and is something that we all look for. And it has that running to the light quality that is really intoxicating. And, I don't know anyone that doesn't want to believe it, but I don't know anyone that really believes it, And it is something that is very difficult for us to run with. But boy, when you do, it's marvelous. There's a piece called Komm du süße Todesstunde, which is another one about death, Come Sweet Hour of Death, which we have performed an awful lot. Unfortunately, it ended up being a piece that we did for, we've had three people die of AIDS in this community, and we always perform this piece for those funerals, and it had a really incredibly profound effect on people, and it's a really, really remarkable piece with the text, the beginning that says, "Come, sweet hour of death, that is like honey in the lion's mouth," and that idea that you go through these sort of jaws of hell to something like honey is a really amazing image, and people were very moved by this, and I think it made a lot of people rethink about death and about, you know, these particular deaths in our community. It is extremely severe. It always comes around to a redemption. It always comes around to the fact that there is hope. But it is, a lot of it, very severe, and very severe in a very kind of down-home way. I mean, there's a piece, in fact, I've been studying because we're going to do it soon, that has the text, you know, the whole world is a hospital and everyone has boils on their skin, and it describes in rather lurid detail how the boils burst and, you know, and pus comes out. You know, this is not something that you usually hear in church these days. It does happen to be somewhat true, however. I mean, that's the thing, it seems to me, about churches, is that nowadays they really are running away from the truth. If you just look around you, you hardly can be too much hellfire. I mean, it really is true.
Do people ever tell you this music is too dark for an Episcopal church in Boston in 1992?
All the time. They're just wrong.
What do they say, and what do you say?
Well, you know, let's have something a little more upbeat. And I just say, you know, look, you can get upbeat anywhere. Turn on the TV if you want to be. Let's be real. This literature is the greatest body of religious music ever written, and that's that. Sorry, it sounds so kind of extreme, but.
What's your sense of Johann Sebastian Bach as a man, as a professional musician, rather like yourself in a certain...
Well, I mean, he is obviously the greatest professional musician that ever lived. I mean, it is when people talk about technique, there's nothing like it. I mean, and even the most irascible and hard-to-please composers say, well, there are composers and then there's Bach. But beyond that, he was a very stubborn, somewhat irascible Saxon with terribly kind of the most hardcore bourgeois values. He had two wives and 22 children. And most of them dying in childbirth. So that, I mean, you can imagine what that did to his own faith. But he is someone whose very bland exterior was hiding something so turbulent and so profound that it's funny to think of this very kind of stolid person containing this many ideas. And he was. I mean, he led this uninteresting life. He was not successful. He was off in a corner. He was not a big deal in his life. I mean, people sort of paid lip service, but it wasn't like he was a big star, like Handel and like a lot of other composers. But, you know, the time tells. As you remember, with the orchestration, that it really can be very transparent and slow. Good, I'm going to begin to correct. Yeah.
is a very dark Lutheran theology. It was written during dark days. We live during dark days now, and that theology doesn't bother me. I mean, it deals a great deal with original sin, repentance, and redemption, which I find to be central to Christian belief.
I also think there are people that find it too serious religiously for them, or too heavy or depressing, and very hellfire and brimstone words, and they just want to be moved by a happy feeling instead and hear something joyous and light. And I think many people object to it in that way.
You can say too.
Heavy is the word most people say. Oh, Bach is so heavy. And you do have those images. You have gaping jaws of death and the flames of hell and God in his wrath, and he's going to do this and he's going to do that, and please save me from this. And this is considered to be very old-fashioned. Craig is somebody who really believes that music means something. He believes that it has a meaning that is applicable to the rest of your life. And it gives him this sort of otherworldly glow sometimes.
Bravo. We even have a low E somewhere.
Good.
Okay.
I think the people who have stuck with Craig through thin and thin, appreciate that vision of his, that music really shows you how to live.
We're still getting this sort of boxy thing. It needs to be totally fluid, leading to the downbeat on that three-quarter note thing. At D, please, sopranos. Two and one.
Are there Bach passages or cantatas where you can say, this music is about something?
Oh, yes. Let's take an example, a piece we're going to do soon, Cantata 109, which the text is, I believe God, therefore help my unbelief. Well, the belief section has this very wonderful long melody with a trumpet doubling the strings that is very, very sort of soothing and really rather grand. And then help my unbelief, it becomes fragmented and everything sort of jumpy and groundless. We can't speak and say, I believe and I don't believe at the same time. But music can. It can say them simultaneously. And that makes it very rich. Because that's really what life is like. When really opposing ideas are living together very uncomfortably.
In my own very different and very humble way, I've had that experience with church, singing church music, of knowing suddenly what Jesus meant when he said, when two or three gather in my name, there am I with you. There is something that happens in the singing of sacred music.
But those are the kind of words that music can really talk about. Because those, first of all, they are something about something transcendent. And that idea that there are two or three people and all of a sudden there is something more than those two or three people. And Bach's setting of that piece, as a matter of fact, in Cantata 42, an alto aria, is one of the absolute transcendent moments in Bach. Because there is this halo around those words, just as surely as those astonishing Giotto halos around those people and make those people in the Scrivini Chapel somehow so much more than human. And this music does that very same thing. It has this sort of bed of string sound with these sinuous and very active, like some little ghostly figure, oboe line that darts, and just like a spirit, like a firefly in a jar. And then the singer sings this rather disjunct, almost conversational line. But we really don't hear the singer. We keep hearing the sort of firefly that it's hard. It's obviously not describable, or else Bach would have written it down instead of made it music. But it really does get at those that idea that, you know, there are two or three, and then there's something more than those two or three.
Well, I think it's true.
Yes.
It is true. It is true. Sense.
It is true in virtually every religious system there is that idea that people can transcend their physical beings, and that there is a spirit. Good, excellent. It needs to be a little livelier. Feel it moving a bit. Let it float away a bit on those cadences, i.e. in the second bar of the second system, when you get to the half note, let that float.
Who's Craig Smith outside of church? Where did he come from? How did he get here?
Well, I'm from the West. I grew up in a totally sort of ordinary rural situation, a little town in the state of Washington, right on the border of Idaho. And, you know, took piano lessons from the little old lady down the street and all of that stuff. And I had a very kind of sort of normal childhood, and but was a very serious pianist. And in fact, really until my 20s, never dreamed of conducting or anything like that. I was strictly wanting to be a famous pianist to play the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto with the New York Philharmonic, you know, so that I had no sort of vision beyond that.
I'm always so envious, I guess, of people who have found a way to see themselves as artists. And I wonder how it happens.
Oh, boy, I didn't see myself as an artist until a few years ago. I think in this country, it is such a strange thing to do that to have a genuine identity as an artist as a young person is very rare and shows a tremendous sort of maturity. I mean, certainly all during school and even afterwards, when I really was making a living in music, somehow if someone would have said, "Are you an artist?" or "Are you making a living in the arts?" I would say, "Well, I guess I am." I mean, the other thing about a performer is that they're not an artist; they're a craftsman. And it is a recreative thing, and it is not creative. And so that I think the distinction should be made between me and a composer or a painter or a poet or whatever. That the recreative process, while I think it's noble, it is a craft.
I know Kurt Mazur, now the conductor of the New York Philharmonic, has come to Emmanuel Church. Has Seiji Ozawa come from the Boston Symphony?
Not that I know of, he may have, but I feel very much almost embarrassed that I think probably a lot of other musicians really have never met Seiji Ozawa, really have virtually had nothing to do with him. We would like to be influenced by the Boston Symphony. Right now, my organization is not very influenced by the. I, of course, go to the concerts and love many of them, but it's not as if we're sort of in any kind of brotherhood. That glow and shrieked. We want all of those.
Craig, what's the connection between the Emmanuel Church and then that rather huge leap into Peter Sellers' world, into Mozart and showbiz around the world?
The connection is that Peter saw that this was a group of people that really were used to interacting with each other in the most sort of thorough way. And he, I think, saw that that was something terribly useful in the world of opera.
It is a phenomenal thing to see the Sellers production with the Craig Smith music. A blind person would hear the straight Mozart, and a deaf person would be looking in on a kind of a soap opera.
Mm-hmm. I'm so used to them now that they seem like just normal way to do Mozart. I find more of a problem with highly paid people sort of wandering around, occasionally kind of posing, but not relating to each other. But our, you know, the switchblades seem much more real to me than, you know, kind of dumb swordplay, badly executed.
Legato, pastoral.
None of it has meant as much to him, I think, as the cantata program. He really doesn't care that he's the conductor. He seems to feel that it's a glorious privilege to be allowed to listen to people sing and play this wonderful music. It's a privilege to him.
Bravo, bravo, excellent. Yeah.
Are you ever tempted to say that the kingdom of God is about singing?
I think singing is about getting there and is about something much more active and much more conflicted. Heavenly choirs sort of don't really interest me very much. It's more the conflict.
Explain that a bit.
Well, I guess it's so cliched, sort of women's voices in high thirds, you know, oohing and aahing when heavenly stuff in music, and there is, in Bach and in Schütz too, is usually about maybe a step on the way when you have a vision of it, but it's not having gotten there. Because none of us knows what's there. And Bach was too honest to think he did.
Explain your own religious outlook. Are you a Christian? Are you an Episcopalian? Are you a Lutheran? Are you a Bachian?
I couldn't call myself any of those things. I am very interested in Christianity. But faith is something that doesn't speak a lot to me. I mean, I'm more interested in doubt. But I'm very interested in the Bible, which has really remarkable things in it and extraordinary stuff in it. And I mean, it is something you can spend a lifetime looking at.
Where do you turn in it?
Well, I'm very interested in the letters of Paul, and they're infuriating, a lot of them. I mean, they're so kind of stuffy everything phobic. But they also have this kind of radiance of believing that Jesus is the way that really is something that I can't believe in. I mean, the thing about Christianity is that it is so cheapened, it seems today, by so much of the Christian institutions are just either ludicrous, like you know, TV evangelists, which, you know, it's hard to imagine anyone taking them seriously, or sort of stuffy and meaningless, like many of the big sort of more mainstream churches. But at the base of it is there's this dusty thing of these people in this little kind of end of the world, in this dusty end of the world, finding amazing ideas that were very new and saying them with a kind of intensity I've never seen anyone else say it. I'll probably be fired for that.
No. What does it mean for you, Craig, to say that there is a religious experience in this music?
My idea of a religious experience is a certain kind of mental discipline that can follow through moral dilemmas. Well, even in the piece Cantata 8, Liebster Gott, there is the dilemma of the sadness of death versus the presumed transcendent going to a better place, that are both of them are presented simultaneously, and they are worked out. There is a genuine kind of autumnal sort of sadness about this piece. And I always remember that this piece always lands in the fall. I mean, in all of Bach's pieces in the fall have this kind of sadness to them. But it also has this glow about it. And those two ideas are worked through. And I think of that as a religious experience. I mean, that is certainly a dilemma, a moral and a, not so much moral, but a religious dilemma of how do we feel about this.
Susan Larson said that Craig Smith sees in this music a way to live. There's a kind of moral instruction in this music. Is that true?
I think it's very difficult to go out in the world after an experience like some of these cantatas and be what we are asked to be, which is thoughtless about the homeless, thoughtless about all of the suffering that we see around you. I mean, it does sensitize you. You can't be as thick-skinned as we in 1992 are asked to be about those less fortunate. I mean, it's just not possible. The potency of the music is absolutely unmistakable. I mean, and it does draw a piece like this opening chorus of Cantata 8. When you're involved in that, and there is this absolutely sort of floating thing in the pizzicato strings and these incredible sinuous oboe lines and the flute doing the bells and then this chorus floating above, when you're involved in that, you are in any function, whether you're an alto or the conductor or the cellist or whatever, you are aware that you are involved in some kind of magical structure. I mean, it cannot help but change you.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this podcast version of our show. Check us out, leave a comment, suggest a show at www.radioopensource.org.
Bach left you these 200 pieces to work with. How long can you keep performing them?
No one's ever asked me that. I don't know.
But there's no end in sight, I hope.
I think of Bach as a lifetime project.